I will oppose the Colombia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, to the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons of metal a day. Now, sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name. In Youngstown.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You know, every time I hear the president say, you know, trust me on those, I sat 20 feet from him when he said that. Trust me on those trade deals. I now think, you know, we've already passed the Colombia, the Corus, the Panama, and now they're talking about the mother of all free trade agreements, this Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreement. And, you know, I've had some folks go, you know, why is Donald Trump doing so well? And I go, you know, why is he doing well in the polls? It's because he's tapping into something very real. And I think it's back to this trade issue. American workers are tired of getting the screws, man. Tired of China kicking our behinds. And unfortunately, the Donald's not the answer. He and his ilk are the cause more than they're the answer. But the rhetoric has got people going, you know, hey, at least somebody's talking about this. Now, what's going on? China's having some problems. And it's reverberating over to us, especially in the steel industry. This summer is going to be this next couple of months going to be very interesting in the steel industry, as the companies here are going, hey, you know, opportunity knocks. Maybe we can go back and get some of those decent family-sustaining wages, some of the fight back on the hours, fight back on the conditions, which is why I've asked Cole Stangler. He's a staff writer over at the International Business Times. He's written a great piece on the China slowdown that is coming to the Midwest. Cole, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be back.
So, you know, I look at this, and I think as you pointed out in your piece, and one of the charts that you have, and I highly suggest people take a look at it. Just go to therickssmithshow.com, click on Cole's name. One of the charts you have there is the production levels of the U.S., the production levels of Korea, and then the production level of China, and they are just off the charts.
Yeah, no, it really is shocking. I mean, the spike really takes off kind of mid-90s, early 2000s, and you can see that Chinese production is just know, balloon since then, and basically dwarfs that of the United States right now.
So what's going on is you're seeing these, and as you point out in your article, we're seeing these companies that have their contracts come up with the steel workers, and now they're looking for concessions because, hey, times look like they could be rough, and it's a good opportunity, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and as people who follow this kind of stuff from the labor end point out, you know, there's nothing particularly new about that strategy if you're an employer, you know, using a downturn in the industry to extract concessions, using it as a pretext to change things that don't necessarily even have to do with the reasons for the downturn. And that's certainly what the union is saying. And so, you know, they'll talk about, you know, the major problem in their estimation is China, basically. You have this massive amount of production in China. Now the Chinese market is slowing down. So you have all this excess steel that's on the market that's coming into the United States. Prices are going down. U.S. steel can't compete with that. And so, you know, the question if you're a worker, a steel worker, is what does the fact that I get overtime for working, you know, more than 8 hours in a day have to do with the fact that, you know, you have this massive, massive amount of Chinese steel hitting the market and putting the company in this downturn. And so that's sort of where the conflict is workers are saying, the union is saying, you know, we don't have anything to do with the problems that you're facing right now. And you're basically using this as a pretext to go after the contract. And in their words, they're saying this is what the proposals the U.S. Steel has on the table right now, they're saying are going back to the 50s and 60s.
Right. Let me ask you this. In talking to the people that you were able to meet there in Granite City, Illinois, which I guess is southern part of Illinois?
Yes, it's right across the river from St. Louis.
So the conversation you had, how much of it do they see as the company taking advantage of this, or do they see it as maybe they've got some interest with the company against our trade policies? Because we really are being pitted against a mercantilist country who's going to cheat at every turn. They cheat on their currency. They cheat in heavily subsidizing and owning their industries. At what point is it that's more the cause than opportunity, or is it just both?
No, I mean, Rick, I mean, that's a really good question. It's something that I was trying to figure out as well, and I think people have different perspectives on it. But basically, I think people that work there feel like they're being left behind, I mean, basically by everybody. They feel like they're being screwed by the Chinese producers. They feel like they're being screwed by the U.S. government for not sticking up enough against, these violations, or not all of them are, but a lot of them can be construed as violations of trade policy. They're also upset at the fact that, U.S. Steel is trying to gut the contract. And so I think like people feel like they have been left behind by basically everybody, and they're sort of just pissed off, and I think it's easy to understand why.
And I would say rightly so, because it comes back to we're not doing enough to protect American jobs and American workers in this country, and it's both sides of the political aisle that have consumed this open border trade ideal that we've been trying for now, 30 some years, and it's just not working, not well for working people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. There's a tremendous amount of frustration about that. And it's not helped also by the fact that, right now as we speak, the U.S. government is negotiating, a Democratic administration is negotiating, a giant trade deal that, as one of the guys I spoke with said, would make NAFTA look like Christmas. And another guy said he thinks that's the nail in the coffin for the steel industry, and that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You're right. It's not only have these policies led to a weakening of the American steel industry over the last few decades, but we're actually about to sign another one of these trade deals that is arguably more significant, covers a larger portion of the global economy than even NAFTA, than some of these smaller trade agreements.
But here's the thing that gets me. And as I was looking at the chart that you included in your piece, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking back to World War II. We're always told, the reason we won World War II is because we could outproduce the world. We were able to build tanks and planes and bombs and all that stuff. I got to be honest, a nation that doesn't produce things is a nation in trouble. And I look at this and, our steel production has actually gone down. While theirs has just gone off the charts, they've got to dump it somewhere. And you look at the need here in the U.S. hasn't gone down. It's just that we've outsourced all that.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a small, a smaller piece of the story also, which is kind of its own conversation. But you have these cheaper mini mills, non-union mini mills that are able to churn out steel at lower costs. So that's another problem. But it's a really difficult landscape. And the scary thing about it too is if you're a steelworker right now, is the downturn in China, threatens to make things worse.
Right.
People have complained about China devaluing currency, before, and now they're doing it even more, or they're pledging to.
Well, I've been talking about their currency manipulation for at least 5 or 6 years now.
Right.
At least. And you go, at some point, don't we, I remember when I had asked Hillary Clinton about this when she was running in 2008. I go, whose fault is it when China's kicking our behind and we allow them to do it? If they're stealing our lunch, whose fault is it? And she said, obviously, it's our fault because we're allowing it. We've basically given them all of our industry and allowed American corporations to move over there and then to bring all their stuff back without really much of a penalty.
Yeah. No, I think you can definitely make the case, and I think the other thing about this too is, even just like talking to people as I was reporting the story, is I think there's this kind of idea, not among people who work in the industry necessarily, but people elsewhere who see just kind of this long, crushing, depressing decline of steel, and they assume that it's something that's inevitable. This is part of, it's ingrained into history, and it's ingrained into economic progress that basically, we just can't produce steel anymore and we're going to, it'll be gone.
Which isn't true, because, I just had a conversation with someone not too long ago who said, in this country, we produce steel much more efficiently than basically any country in the world.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I mean, I think you can make the case maybe in the 70s and 80s there were some plants that weren't the most efficient plants in the U.S. But I think right now, I mean, just to be able to survive in the global market for steel, the plants that do exist that are, you know, in the United States, and keep in mind, you know, way, you know, fewer of them exist than they did in the past. Those plants that are there right now, like the one in Granite City, those are, you know, these are really highly efficient, you know, state-of-the-art technology plants that are around. And so, I think you're absolutely right.
So let me ask you this, Cole, because, you know, in any of these stories, what you end up getting is a portion of the population who goes, I don't care. Those union workers, they're overpaid. You know, much like in the 70s, they said, well, you know, they get 13 weeks vacation. That's why the company went down, which is ridiculous. They didn't get 13 weeks vacation a year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's this perception that they have all of these things and that life is so wonderful for them. How much of is the perception of maybe people not being as upset or as involved in this story as I think should be?
Mm-hmm. You mean how are people reacting? Yes. to steelworkers benefits? I mean, you know, I think in a town, you know, Illinois is a huge state, but I think, you know, a town like Granite City has been the town has been really dominated by the presence of steel manufacturing for actually over a century. So people in the community feel connected in a way to the plant, you know, in a way that, you know, you might not have elsewhere. So, you know, people who work at like at pizza parlors, people who produce clothes in the town.
It's the economic driver of the city. It's the center of the city. It's where the wealth comes from.
Right, right. You know, and it's been there for a very long time. And I, you know, even to I was fascinated as somebody who's interested in labor history, you know, to find out that the union hall that's been in Granite City has been around for a very long time. Eugene Debs spoke there back in the 20s. It's a town with a really robust historic tradition of being a bastion of organized labor and of steel production. And so people there are kind of anxious about what's going on. The other thing to point out, which, you know, I haven't said already, is that this plant almost closed. Was almost temporarily idled a few months ago. The company's U.S. Steel said in, I think, March that they were going to idle the plant in May, and so that didn't happen. So it's like, you know, people are already on edge because of that, and now you have these tough contract talks coming up, or going on right now, I should say, where the company is trying to extract as much as they can. It's a really nervous time for the community.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's what you expect before contract time. You expect those kind of announcements, as anybody who's been in a union in a manufacturing facilities understands. They're going to use those threats of, hey, you know what, if we don't get what we want, we're going to move overseas. We're going to move down south. We're going to take the jobs and go, so you better take what we give you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right. Right.
I mean, that seems to be, you know, that's the MO. It just is what it is. So, you know, in looking at this, because, again, it comes back to we're still arguing and debating the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
Yeah.
In looking at this situation, does not passing an agreement like that help this situation any? I know the steelworkers have done a bunch of work throughout the Obama administration to fight back on some of the the dumping, some of the trade violations, some of that stuff, even if the administration doesn't want to. Where do you see that going?
I mean, I think you can make a case that getting, you know, signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, getting it finalized, having Congress pass it will make things worse. I think that case, you know, is easier to make than saying that things are going to improve just because we're not going to people don't sign the TPP. I mean, I think they're in a bad position right now, and so the fear is if you sign the TPP, just because China's not part of the agreement, doesn't mean that you're not getting because of the weak rules of origin, which is a complicated part of the agreement. Basically, you can have Chinese steel benefiting from the agreement coming through. Imports to the U.S. from other countries that are part of the agreement. So like South Korea, Malaysia, some of those other countries would basically be the conduit for Chinese steel to continue to hit the U.S. market, but with more benefits. And so I think the fear is the TPP is going to really aggravate things. I think it's hard to say that the not passing TPP is going to be the magic bullet. I think there's other things that people would say, you know, like becoming more aggressive on cracking down on currency manipulation. And also these dumping cases as well. You know, what's interesting is that you know, you were talking about, you know, to what extent companies and you know, the companies and the unions are in the union are in the same boat. And on this, they've actually teamed up. So they've teamed up to file these trade cases. And they've actually won a bunch of them. They've won over 30 going back to 2000, accusing China and other countries of dumping steel and illegally subsidizing their steel. The problem is those cases are really expensive. They take a long time. So as people describe it there, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. So it's very difficult.
Yeah, and it's one of these things where you've got to go back and you've got to start, in my view, you've got to start looking at things, steel and manufacturing, not just from a manufacturing perspective and build, but from a national security perspective. At some point, in my view, mm-hmm. you look at mm-hmm. all the things that we don't make in this country anymore, and if you're going to be a military power, you need to have, in my view, the capability to produce. Just that simple for me.
Yeah, I mean that's an argument that you know could get some traction, maybe from Republicans, you know, more than saying let's protect the decent paying unionized manufacturing jobs would.
Yeah, I mean, now last line of questioning I've got for you: does anybody think this is going to turn ugly there, like it has here in the Pittsburgh area, where they've locked out ATI has locked out 2,200. Of their workers and are actually bringing scabs in across the picket line. Does anyone see it going to that, or what's the feel you're getting?
I mean, it's really hard to say, but my hunch is, I think at this point, I mean, so first off, I should say, I mean, the union is telling people to be prepared for the possibility of a strike or a lockout, like any good union would do.
Right.
But my hunch is that I think the sides are so far apart right now, that it probably wouldn't even make sense for there to be, you know, for the union to call a strike, you know, for instance, because they're just so far away from even any sort of agreement. So I think if I had to speculate, I think that, you know, the deadline is September 1st, which is rapidly approaching. You know, they're not going to hit that deadline. I suspect we might see things kind of play out. I don't think there's a risk right now for an immediate strike or lockout. It's just my hunch. I think that the sides, again, are just so far apart right now that it's probably not in either of their interests to do that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on this. And as it continues, we'd love to have you come back and keep us up to date and informed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much, Cole. I appreciate it, man. Great piece.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cole. Cole Stengel. You can check out his piece, therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Cole's name, take you right there. We've got a link to the article, China Slowdown Comes to the Midwest, Anxiety Grips a U.S. Steel Town. Going to take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.